Welcome, dear listeners, and welcome to Iran Radio. It's a pleasure to have you with us on Iran Radio here in the capital, Tehran. Here's what's just around the corner in the next hour. We've got more enriching content to line up for the rest of the hour, so let's take a look at what's coming your way. Next, we'll bring you Iran Today. After that, enjoy another round of radio productions. Then we'll present Spring of Truth. Coming up next, Iran Today. Stay tuned.
The 8-year defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
In the quiet of the early morning hours on June 13th, a dramatic and unprovoked escalation rocked West Asia, sending shockwaves far beyond the region. Backed by the United States, Israel launched a sudden and highly coordinated airstrike on Iranian soil. Targets included everything from civilian neighborhoods in Tehran to key military infrastructure, and perhaps most alarmingly, Iran's nuclear facilities in Natanz and Isfahan. This attack set in motion what would become a 12-day conflict. The first day was catastrophic for Iran. In addition to losing top-ranking military officers and nuclear scientists, Tehran found itself scrambling for a response as it prepared for its sixth round of nuclear negotiations with Washington, negotiations that were, for all practical purposes, obliterated by the bombs that fell on its cities. But the story doesn't end there. They came to talk, but halfway through the negotiation, they reached for the trigger instead. Now, the question isn't just about diplomacy, it's about betrayal. What happens when a superpower trades trust for ambush? And can you ever negotiate with someone who has already decided that you shouldn't walk away alive? Mr. Ahmad Sobhani, Iran's former ambassador to Venezuela.
The fact that Americans are unreliable is nothing new. They have always been that way. That's why the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, never trusted their negotiation office from the start and said negotiations would only complicate things and not solve them. That's why direct talks were refused. The talks we had were indirect, but even then, their deceit was evident. In five rounds of negotiations, Trump always claimed progress was being made, while in reality, there was none. They had ulterior motives, and by attacking Iran in the middle of negotiations, they showed the world their true colors. Inside Iran, some believed negotiations with the U.S. could yield results, but they didn't realize you can't negotiate with a wolf.
What began as a U.S. distancing itself from Israel's attack quickly escalated into a direct American strike on Iran's nuclear sites. On June 22nd, the U.S. launched airstrikes on Natanz, Isfahan, and Fordo, using bunker-busting munitions to target Iran's most secure underground facilities. Officially, the strikes were framed as a preemptive move to stop Iran from developing nuclear weapons. But just weeks earlier, both U.S. intelligence and IAEA reports had confirmed Iran had no such plans. Mr. Soheil Jamshidpour, an Iranian political expert.
Israel and the U.S. Claimed that the nature of the attacks were preemptive, and it was a means to hinder Iran's efforts to develop and manufacture a nuclear bomb. Now, the question is, does a preemptive strike have any position in international law and regulations.
Iran جزء آژانس بین‌المللی انرژی اتمی است.
Iran is a member of the NPT and all the nuclear non-proliferation conventions. This means Iran considers itself bound by all the rules governing nuclear activity and operates within the internationally accepted framework. In other words, all its activities have been under the supervision for the International Atomic Energy Agency. In fact, no country has welcomed the inspectors more than Iran. Now, suppose Iran did something unacceptable. The IAEA reports it to the Board of Governors, which may refer it to the UN Security Council for further review and decision. It's completely unacceptable and against all international laws for the Zionist regime and the US, both nuclear armed, to suddenly decide to attack Iran's nuclear facilities and call it a preemptive strike. Israel, which has hundreds of nuclear warheads, is not an NPT member, and expressing concern over Iran's peaceful program makes the whole story ridiculous and surreal.
The attack sparked a powerful and decisive Iranian response. Operation True Promise 3, and left the U.S. media and political landscape deeply divided. CNN discussed the potential $30 billion investment in Iran's civilian nuclear program, while Donald Trump dismissed it as fake and warned of more military action. Meanwhile, Secretary of State Mark Rubio pushed for direct talks with Tehran. This fractured approach reveals not just a lack of strategic coherence, but also growing frustration with Congress, as Democrats criticize the White House's OPEC decision-making in a crisis that's far from over. This is Mr. Sayed Reza Sadrul-Husseini, an Iranian senior expert on international relations. What do you think are some of the consequences for Netanyahu and Trump after the attack on Iran?
ترامپ محبوبیت ویژه‌ای در بین افکار عمومی جهانی نداره. اما
Even before the attack on Iran, Trump was not particularly popular globally. After the attack, his popularity even at home reached its lowest point because the American people do not want their country dragged into another foolish war. The same holds true in the occupied territories. Not only Netanyahu's opponents, but many of those who work with him believe that the attack on Iran would accelerate the Israeli Prime Minister's exit from power. These are just short-term consequences of the attack.
When a reality TV star took the White House, global politics became a stage, and the script changed dramatically. So who do you get to run the world's nuclear watchdog? According to some, a man with more ties to Mossad than to transparency. Hence the question arises, how can an agency demand trust when its own leader seems to have lost it? In the wake of the Israeli and U.S. strikes on Iran's nuclear facilities, a critical question is emerging. What role did the International Atomic Energy Agency play in escalating this crisis? At the center of the controversy is IAEA Director General Rafael Grossi, whose handling of Iran's nuclear file has sparked fierce criticism and raised alarms about the neutrality of international oversight. Iranian officials say Grossi is aligned too closely with Western powers, and particularly with Israel, in a way that undermines the agency's impartiality. The tension between Tehran and the IAEA has been simmering for years, but it reached a boiling point in the days before the first Israeli airstrikes. A controversial report from the IAEA highlighting uranium enrichment levels in Iran was quickly used by Israel as justification for its military actions. Although Grossi later acknowledged that the IAEA had found no evidence of Iran pursuing nuclear weapons, the damage was already done. The report had been cited to support a resolution at the IAEA Board of Governors accusing Iran of non-compliance, effectively setting the stage for the Israeli attacks that followed. Grossi's actions, along with his failure to condemn the attacks, have severely undermined the IAEA's credibility. Iran, long a partner in the agency's nuclear oversight, now sees Grossi's IAEA as a tool of Western political interests. This shift led Iran's Majlis to vote to suspend cooperation with the IAEA, signaling a deepening distrust. Mr. Ruhollah Mudabbir, another Iranian political expert, talked to us about the destructive role of the IAEA.
What is very important is the role of the IAEA as a factor in this hybrid war. Before the Israeli aggression, IAEA Director Grossi gave false reports and accusations to some Board of Governors members, which led to the joint resolution by France, Britain, Germany, and the U.S. against Iran. While the Zionist regime crossed all red lines and invaded Iranian territory, killing defenseless women and children, assassinating senior Iranian commanders, and attacking critical infrastructure, military bases, residential areas, hospitals, and nuclear facilities, staying in the NPT and continuing cooperation with the IAEA has no meaning, especially since the IAEA took no action to defend Iran. Reliable information shows the agency gave intelligence on nuclear scientists to Israel for assassination. Grossi's role as an intelligence agent is clear, and the agency itself acts as a coordinated espionage network against independent countries, like what happened in Iraq when the IAEA provided Iraq's nuclear scientists information to Israel. Similar actions were taken by the agency. We saw that every time Grossi visited Russian nuclear plants, Zaporizhia and Kursk, NATO forces attacked these sites and Russian defenses after he provided coordinates. This alone shows Grossi is a multi-sided spy, and the IAEA is essentially an intelligence service.
We have a lot more to cover today, but first let's take a moment to catch up on the latest headlines.
Hello everyone, welcome to the news section of this program. Here we'll go over some important news headlines. Tehran Times: Araghchi urges UN to hold Israel and US accountable for their aggression. Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi has formally called on the United Nations Security Council to recognize the Zionist regime and the United States as perpetrators of an act of aggression against Iran and to hold them accountable under international law. In a detailed letter addressed to UN Security General Antonio Guterres and Security Council President Carolyn Rodriguez Burkett, Araghchi warned that the attacks carried out by Israel and supported by Washington between June 13th and 24th constitutes a blatant violation of the UN Charter and multiple binding international agreements. The Israel regime's military aggression deliberately targeted residential areas, civilian infrastructure, and public services, including hospitals and relief centers, the letter stated. Araghchi emphasized that these acts not only breach international and humanitarian law, but also represent serious violations of the fundamental right to life as enshrined in Article 6 of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. He further highlighted that several Iranian nuclear facilities under the supervision of the International Atomic Energy Agency, including sites in Qom, Arak, Natanz, and Isfahan, were attacked, adding that these actions also violate the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, IAEA regulations, and related UN resolutions. The Guardian: Benjamin Netanyahu corruption trial delayed on diplomatic and security grounds. The Israeli court's decision to cancel this week's hearing in the long-running trial came after Donald Trump said the case should be thrown out. An Israeli court has canceled this week's hearings in Benjamin Netanyahu's long-running corruption trial, accepting a request made by the Prime Minister on classified diplomatic and security grounds. It comes after Donald Trump last week called for the case to be thrown out. In remarks on social media, the U.S. president suggested the trial could interfere with Netanyahu's ability to join negotiations with Hamas and Iran, adding that the U.S. was not going to stand for the continued prosecution, prompting Netanyahu to thank him in a message on X. Meh News: IAEA inspectors cannot enter Iran nuclear facilities, Iravani. Iran's ambassador and permanent representative to the United Nations, Amir Said Iravani, says that IAEA inspectors are currently not able to enter Iran's nuclear facilities. In remarks made to Al Monitor in an interview published Thursday, Ambassador Iravani declared, "Iran continues to insist that enrichment must take place on its own soil." The comment comes on the heels of a halt in fighting that ended the Israeli regime's 12-day war on Iran, which ranged from June 13th to 24th. Reuters: IAEA chief says Iran could be enriching uranium within months. Iran could be producing enriched uranium in a few months, the head of the UN nuclear watchdog, Rafael Grossi, was quoted as saying on Sunday, raising doubts about how effective U.S. strikes to destroy Tehran's nuclear program have been. U.S. officials have stated that their strikes obliterated key nuclear sites in Iran, although U.S. President Donald Trump said on Friday he would consider bombing Iran again if Tehran is enriching uranium to worrisome levels. The capacities they have are there. They can have, you know, in a matter of months, I would say, a few cascades of centrifuges spinning and producing enriched uranium or less than that, Grossi told CBS News in an interview. Anadolu Agency. Iran warns of crushing response if attacked again, slams Trump's remarks as nonsense. Brigadier General Ramazan Sharif, spokesperson for the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, dismissed Trump's recent statements as nonsense, saying they were the result of a heavy defeat to Iran. If Iran's national interests and assets are attacked again, our response this time will be different, more crushing and destructive, and could accelerate the collapse of the American regime, Sharif warned in a statement broadcast by the Iranian Fars News Agency. The comment came after Trump on Friday sharply criticized the leader of the revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, warning that he would consider bombing the country again if Tehran continued enriching uranium. And thank you for joining us in this section. Please do stay tuned for the main narrative.
Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
They said it was impossible that Israel's million-dollar missile shield would stop anything from anywhere. Then came Iran's missiles, homegrown, defiant, and precise. They broke through not with miracles, but with calculation and resolve. How did a country under the so-called crippling sanctions challenge the tech fortress of a global power? And what does this mean for future warfare?
On the first day, we used our older generation missiles, but each day we revealed a new trump card. On the fifth day of the war, when they asked if Israel wanted a ceasefire, Trump said, "Why would Israel want a ceasefire when they have the upper hand?" But on the 12th day, they came begging and requested a ceasefire.
It began with Israel's bold announcement. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu declared that Israel would achieve nothing short of a sweeping transformation in West Asia, starting with the destruction of Iran's nuclear program, paving the way for the so-called regime change in Tehran. We also talked to Ms. Afifeh Abedi, an Iranian journalist and a researcher on foreign policy. What were some of the Israeli-American objectives of this war, and to what extent do you think they achieved their goals?
The Americans and Israelis realized they could not achieve all their goals, like completely shutting down Iran's nuclear program and removing enriched uranium through negotiation. They wanted to extract all concessions from Iran without giving anything in return. This is one reason they attacked Iran and targeted our nuclear facilities. Another reason is to weaken Iran's unique regional position. Iran, regardless of its nuclear capabilities, holds a prominent political, economic, and geopolitical status that has often blocked Western hegemony. This was another motive for the US and Israel to deliver a heavy blow to Iran through war and, if possible, achieve their long-held dream of regime change. But in reality, this was just wishful thinking.
But just 12 days later, the war came to an abrupt halt. Pressure from US President Donald Trump pushed Netanyahu to accept a ceasefire, an attempt to save the regime and to prevent the US from getting deeper into the conflict. Why do you think the war didn't last for long? I mean, after 12 days, the Israeli side accepted or perhaps suggested a ceasefire.
As American sources have revealed, this 12-day war was a calculated operation they had been preparing for years, but they made many miscalculations. They mistakenly believed that once a foreign agent started the war, Iran would descend into chaos and civil war, enabling them to quickly reach their political and military goals. This was merely an illusion. They also thought that surprising Iran would finish the job. Iran, which was preparing to negotiate with the U.S., was caught off guard by the attack, but gradually took control and responded powerfully to Israel and the U.S. That's why, after 12 days, they asked for a ceasefire, presumably to regroup and rethink their strategy.
In those intense days of conflict, American bombers targeted Iran's key nuclear sites, Fordo, Natanz, and Isfahan. But questions quickly emerged about whether these strikes had dealt any decisive blow to Iran's nuclear program. A leaked CNN report sourced from U.S. military intelligence suggested that the damage to Iran's nuclear program might be short-lived. Iran could rebuild in a matter of months. The leak sent shockwaves through the American media landscape, angering President Trump, who launched a fierce campaign against CNN and others for casting doubt on the success of the operation. The tension between official narratives and media reports highlighted a deeper divide over the true impact of the attack and the public's perception of the war's outcome. Meanwhile, Mr. Jamshidpour drew our attention to an interesting point.
Iran has pursued peaceful nuclear technology for decades, long before the 1979 Islamic Revolution, as a necessary means for national development. Even under Mohammad Reza Shah, who was essentially a U.S. puppet, America opposed its use of this technology. Consequently, Iran sought help from the Soviet Union and France to develop its nuclear facilities. Interestingly, the Americans even opposed the steel industry under the Shah, prompting him to turn against to the USSR. In short, the U.S. has opposed Iran's industrial advancement before and after the revolution, now using every pretext to stop the nuclear industry. Recently, with greater control over the IAEA, they have tried to pressure Iran through influence on the agency's reports.
But the military dynamics told a different story. Despite damage to its infrastructure, Iran launched an effective missile counteroffensive, striking Tel Aviv and other Israeli cities. Israel's anti-missile system struggled to cope with Iran's precise strikes, and reports indicated that Israel's stockpile of interceptors were rapidly depleting. Meanwhile, Israel's much-hyped objectives, disrupting Iran's nuclear program and achieving regime change, remained unfulfilled. The Iranian response was coordinated, targeted, and devastating. In less than 2 weeks, Iran had crippled the backbone of Israel's military and technological command. These are some of the targets Iran hit. The Kirya, Israel's version of the Pentagon. Camp Moshe Dayan, a training center for intelligence officers. Tel Nof Air Base, home to long-range F-15s. Nevatim and Hadzerim, bases for F-35 stealth jets. Ovda, a command and control center. But Iran didn't stop at airfields. Cyber warfare hubs in Be'er Sheva, including the Gav Yam Negev Tech Park. Energy infrastructure, Haifa, Hadera, Ashdod. Mossad headquarters in Herzliya, the Interior Ministry, Ben Gurion Airport, even near Netanyahu's family villa in Caesarea.
The Israelis came in with all their power and years of planning, backed by the U.S. Trump was openly involved, even telling Tehran to evacuate. The Americans thought the Israelis could fight Iran alone. But when Israel began to crumble, they themselves had to openly join the war alongside NATO, with full military might, weapons and fighter jets to intercept Iranian missiles and drones. But the defensive and offensive weakness of NATO, Israel, and the US became clear, and the superiority of Iranian weaponry was evident worldwide. The world saw how we resisted with our indigenous weapons and brought them to their knees.
Back in the occupied territories, economic damage in Israel was severe, with estimates ranging from $3 to $5.3 billion in initial losses.
How do you assess the deterrence power of Iran's missiles?
After Saddam Hussein's attack on Iran, the defense doctrine of the Islamic Republic became deeply intertwined with self-reliance. The Iranians realized they could not depend on others to defend their land and had to achieve self-sufficiency in defense. The effectiveness of Iranian forces in defending the country against Israeli and American attacks can be heard from CENTCOM commanders and veteran U.S. soldiers who were surprised by the intensity and precision of Iran's response, especially in the war's final hours when the Israeli regime and its allies, despite having the most advanced military equipment, could do little to counter Iran's retaliatory strikes. Before direct confrontation, Israelis mocked Iran's missile capabilities, calling it a bluff. But after Operation Promise 1 and 2, and especially Operation Promise 3, which inflicted heavy blows on Israel, they realized the true extent of Iran's deterrent power. Their desperate plea for a ceasefire after 12 days said it all.
As the war ended, it was clear that Israel's military ambitions had faltered and the political fallout could be significant. What happens next for Netanyahu? And what does this war mean for the future of West Asian geopolitics? The enemies were expecting applause. Instead, they faced resistance. When foreign forces struck Iran, they weren't met with surrender, but solidarity. They miscalculated badly. The attacks didn't trigger what they call regime change. It crushed the illusion that it ever could. In fact, the American-Israeli fantasy met the hard truth of national unity, as always. On June 28th, Saturday morning, Tehran's streets filled with tens of thousands of mourners, honoring the victims of Israel's 12-day war against Iran. The procession, described as historic, paid tribute to 60 martyrs, including top military commanders and nuclear scientists, all killed in the war. The atmosphere was one of defiance and resolve as the crowd chanted slogans condemning Israel and the United States. It was a powerful display of national unity.
In an utterly shameless way, so-called human rights advocates and defenders of international law have trampled on every rule, law, and international obligation and continue to do so. We still witness bizarre statements and positions from Western countries. For example, the German Chancellor openly said, Israel is doing the dirty work on behalf of them, showing they have no commitment to moral principles or international rules and openly admit it. In France, statements from officials clearly support the illegal and aggressive attacks of the Zionist regime. This justification and normalization of crimes is itself the worst crime.
Despite the war's devastating toll, it galvanized Iranians, uniting them, even those critical of the government, against external aggression. In the end, Iran emerged from the conflict, bruised but emboldened. Israel, facing unexpected costs and the U.S. seen as reckless, found their regional influence severely diminished.
Over the past 2 years, the Zionist regime, backed by the U.S. and parts of NATO, has carried out a series of actions aimed at changing the geopolitical landscape of the region. In other words, they seek to fragment the region and implement their so-called Greater Middle East or American Middle East plan, which was unveiled in 2000. However, its execution has faced a major obstacle known as the resistance axis, led by Iran. Therefore, an attack on Iran, with the goal of weakening and dividing it, has always been on the table for the Americans and Israelis. Of course, Iran has always been aware of this and has calibrated its defensive capabilities accordingly, so that whenever the U.S. and Israel decide to strike, it can defend itself, something we witnessed clearly in the recent war.
That's all for today. Thank you from the whole team. Until next time, take care.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Bazaar.
If you look around, nearly every object you see is made of raw material extracted from a mine. Basically, if you can't grow it, you have to mine it. The extraction of minerals, metals, and fuels from the ground is one of humankind's oldest industries. Never more than now has society been so dependent on greater variety and larger volumes of mined products. So it's no surprise that mining fuels our modern world and makes economies grow. Hello and welcome to another edition of Bazaar. I'm your host Alireza Ikhtiarzadeh, and this week we will be exploring the mining industry while shining the spotlight on the machinery used in this sector. We wanted to see what types of machines are used and who is actively manufacturing them. Plus, we wanted to understand why the mining sector is crucial to the national economy and how manufacturers contribute to its progress. So, let's roll out the show. Our quest for answers led us to Shahrud city in Semnan province, where we visited a company specializing in manufacturing various mining machines. With nearly 20 years of experience, this knowledge-based company is active in a host of fields. It conducts research, development, and production of equipment needed in various industries. That being said, it also manufactures a variety of excavating, drilling, trenching, and digging machines. The life of any product begins in the design room. This company has researched and developed these machines and has perfected their performance. Optimizing the machine size, speed, and power to carry out tasks has also reduced the expenses related to projects where these machines are used. These machines can be used in agriculture and road maintenance, among other medium-scale construction projects. Most materials needed to make these machines can be purchased inside Iran. Steel sheets, gears, wires, and whatever else is required to build the machine can be domestically found. And if a design requires a particular part, this company can make its own molds to create the parts. You might find it interesting that these machines are currently imported, as there is a high demand among mining companies for equipment. So indigenizing the production of mining machines has been a big step towards supporting this sector. Another benefit to local production is it saves the country millions by cutting back on imports. The beating heart of this knowledge-based company is its research and development department. Here is where all the magic happens. This area employs some of the most talented and experienced specialists to research, design products, and optimize existing ones. But that's not all. The research and development department also studies future projects. This company also dabbles in making equipment used to harness renewable energy. This company not only uses its own expert staff, but also stays up to date on the latest knowledge by maintaining links with the Industrial University of Shahrud. It collaborates with academic institutions and exchanges knowledge with them too. Furthermore, this knowledge firm also uses capacities and resources made available by Semnon Tech Park. Among its services, it offers the execution of projects through contracting. For example, it has used its machines to complete piping and installation of telecommunications manholes for intercity networks. Another example is carving drainage systems in agricultural fields using its trenchers. Over the years, this company has made a variety of award-winning machines, such as drilling machines equipped with fiber optic lights. Moreover, this company has invented 6 products that have been internationally patented. This knowledge-based manufacturer has never stopped eyeing the future and has plans to expand its production units and product portfolio in the coming years. The company we just mentioned is part of the puzzle that helps Iran's mining sector thrive. It is one of Iran's key industries, as the country is one of the top 10 mineral-rich nations globally. Roughly 7% of global mineral reserves can be found in Iran, making it one of the most important mineral producers in the world. Numbers from Iran's Trade Promotion Organization show that last year the sector saw a growth in exports. Government officials, however, say export figures could still be much higher. Furthermore, efforts have been placed on encouraging research and production in knowledge-based firms to increase specialized production, such as mining machines, in the market. And here is where knowledge-based companies play a big role. Okay, time for me to take a little break from here and divert your attention to a report that I made earlier in the week. Hey everyone, welcome to another special feature of Bazaar. Today we are discussing energy production, specifically electricity production through gas turbines and some of the problems that come with it. So at different times of the year, mainly during the summer, we get sporadic blackouts at peak hours, at one of the peak hours, let's say around 12 at noon until 4 to 5 p.m. Because we cannot store electricity, electricity production must always match electricity consumption. But because of the temperature during these hours, during this time of the year, during the summer, high temperatures in particular negatively affect electricity production through gas turbines. So first we're going to take a look at, well, why that is and how gas turbines work. And also, we believe that we have found a solution at Sharif Innovation Center, in one of the companies that has made that solution, and we're going to check that out too. Why do high temperatures negatively affect the performance of a gas turbine? Well, bear with me as I try to explain how a gas turbine works through this prototype that they have here. This is the prototype of the device that would be used at scale. This is not at scale. So imagine this is the gas turbine. How it works is that it sucks air through these air ducts, and the temperature of that air is very important. I'm going to get back to that. The air goes through a compressor here. The compressor compresses the air, which we would need the compressed air for the combustion chamber. A combustion chamber essentially makes this work exactly like a plane engine or a car engine. A car engine is slightly different because the movement that it produces is linear, whereas the plane engine has rotary movement. So that's exactly what it is like, because it produces rotary movement. So in the combustion chamber, we add a certain type of gas to the compressed air, and then a little spark creates an explosion, and the explosion, the high pressure air, would then spin our turbines. And the turbines, which have movement in them, are connected to a generator. And the generator's job is to create, is to turn movement into electricity, which goes through the power grid and then gets to whoever needs it. Now, the thing here, the important thing about the air temperature is that we need ideal conditions, ideally, for the machine to work at peak performance. And that ideal condition is at sea level 15 degrees Celsius. So the air, ideally, is 15 degrees Celsius, but we don't get that kind of temperature in a lot of places, especially in a hot and dry climate. So we have a couple of options to alleviate that problem. Number one, the inefficient option is to work the compressor a lot more, which would use a lot more energy, but that's not even the issue. The issue is that there's a lot easier of a way. So what they have found at TEPCO company is that they have instead tried to use an ice storage unit to work as a thermal storage compartment, because the thermal storage capacity of ice is 100 times more than that of the water. So here they create ice essentially at midnight until the morning when no one is using the power and the air is colder, because that is what happens. The difference between temperatures during the day and temperatures during the night in dry climates is pretty massive. So it's a lot easier to create the ice during that time. So they do that so that in the morning or at noon during peak hours, 12 p.m. to like 4 or 5 p.m., they have the ice to cool the water that is in the storage, and the cooled water goes through a radiator behind the air duct so that the air, the probably hot air that comes through the chamber, is cooled using the water that is in the ice storage compartment. That water cools the air down to like 15 degrees and gives us ideal conditions to work with. So the compressor doesn't need to work that hard. We get our ideal conditions through the ice storage unit. And that is how they are able to offset the amount of electricity that we would lose if we were to use the compressor a lot harder. And that's pretty much how a gas turbine works as well, but also this is the innovation here. A better way to cool the air and get the machine, get a gas turbine to work at peak performance. There are other less efficient methods of cooling the water that comes through the chamber. Both of them are called evaporative cooling. The first type is done through a wet media, most likely a cooling pad that you see in water coolers everywhere. So how it works is that there is a lot of surface and they run water through it, and the air is going to go through this cooling pad. So as the air goes through the cooling pad, the water absorbs the heat from the air and evaporates. Evaporation is an endothermic procedure, which is heat absorbing, which means that the heat is absorbed from the air and transferred to the water, which evaporates, making the air that runs through the cooling pad a lot cooler. This is a rather wasteful method because, well, you're using water, because in the method that I showed you, you don't use water. The water is just circulated back into the system. This one, you use water, and it's just generally not that efficient. The other method is even more inefficient. You see it in a lot of places in like outdoors restaurants. They spray water through the air that is going to go through the chamber, and the extremely tiny water droplets absorb the heat from the air and evaporate as they are sprayed. This also absorbs heat from the air, and that is why when you go through the spray of water, you feel a cool breeze, because the air is a lot cooler, because its heat is transferred to the water molecules. So both of these methods are pretty inefficient, and I just wanted you to know about other methods that are used, but they are definitely more inefficient. And this chart is a demonstration of how our thermal storage system would perform in an actual 400 megawatt hour power plant system. When the ice is getting used during in midday, it bumps up the production by a difference of 60 megawatts in a regular 400 megawatt hour power plant. Well, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you for tuning in. It's bye for now.
You can talk it down, turn the other way. Fear the truth, but it won't go away. Can you hear it calling? Yeah. You can write it down, but nobody cares. It's an untold story of our biggest fears. It can reach you with no warning. Yeah, yeah. When the sun there's a part of me that won't understand, having sleepless nights with my head in my hands. I'm here and tears are falling, yeah. If I could right the wrongs, would you lend me a hand? I would make a difference to this beautiful land. If I'm nothing, I have my intention. When the sun goes down and there's nothing left around, can you feel it? Can you feel it? When your knees are on the ground, you may fear, but it's allowed. Are you listening? 'Cause I need forgiving. I need forgiving.
Allah, 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 Allah.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می‌کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله dear audience welcome to a new episode of Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio. This is Zainab Musavi and what we do in this program is to listen to certain viewpoints of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi who was the great founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran and then try to shed light and talk about some of these beautiful viewpoints. Okay, well, about the concept of oppression, he said, the oppressed must rise against the oppressors, for silence in the face of injustice is a betrayal of humanity. You see, this quotation from Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh underscores the fundamental principle that standing against oppression and injustice is a moral and religious duty. Defending the oppressed and resisting tyranny is rooted in divine commandments and prophetic traditions. In Surah An-Nisa, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم O you who have believed, be persistently standing firm in justice. Witness for Allah even if it be against yourselves or parents or relatives. Surah An-Nisa, as we said, verse number 135. You see, this verse emphasizes the importance of justice even when it conflicts with personal interests, and it highlights the duty to oppose oppression.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi.
Sallallahu
Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wa sallam and other infallible imams alayhim assalam have conveyed different narrations that they all emphasize resistance against tyranny. Imam Ali alayhi salam, for instance, in his Nahjul Balagha, asserts that help your brother whether he is oppressed or the oppressor. When asked how to assist the oppressed, he replies, by preventing the oppressor from committing injustice. This highlights the responsibility to intervene against injustice to uphold moral righteousness. And Imam Khomeini's call reflects these teachings, that silence in the face of injustice is a betrayal of divine and human values. You know, in Shia theology, it venerates the oppressed and encourages believers to be active agents of justice, and they must align with the concept that true faith entails standing against tyranny. So resisting oppression is not just a political stance in Islam, but a spiritual obligation, and it is rooted in the divine mandate to uphold justice and dignity for all the human beings.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Was a spring of truth, a selection of Imam Khomeini's viewpoints.
Never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back, dear listeners. I'm glad to be with you here on Iran Radio as we step into another hour of engaging and meaningful programming. We'll begin with news this hour, bringing you the latest global headlines and key developments to keep you informed and up to date. Right after the news, stay tuned for a new edition of Radio Productions. Next, we invite you to join A to Z of Life, and to round out the hour, we'll return once more to Radio Productions. Coming up next, news this hour. Stay with us. There is much more ahead.
This This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Israel's relentless strikes on the Gaza Strip claims the lives of more Palestinian civilians in the besieged territory. The United Nations warns that hunger crisis in Gaza has reached an unprecedented level. And Israeli settlers' latest attacks have killed two Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. Welcome, you've tuned into World News live from Tehran with me, Zakaria Zainab. Thank you so much for joining us. We start our first line in Gaza, where the territory has endured yet another deadly day as Israeli forces intensify their relentless bombardment of the besieged territory. According to Gaza's health officials, at least 45 Palestinians were killed on Friday. One of the latest Israeli attacks killed at least four and injured 10 others in a house in East Gaza City. In the western part of Gaza City, four people were killed in tent housing displaced people. Nine others were killed in the Al-Mawasi area near Khan Yunis in the bombing of the tent. Earlier in the day, at least 11 more people were killed while seeking aid near the U.S.-Israeli centers. The U.N. says nearly 800 Palestinians have been killed at U.S.-Israeli aid points over the past week by Israeli fire. Since the onset of the Israeli genocide in October 2023, over 57,800 Palestinians have been killed and nearly 137,900 others injured. Our correspondent in Darul Bala, Mutiabu Musabi, has provided us with further details on the U.S.-Israeli genocide in the Gaza Strip. Let's take a listen.
Israeli airstrikes and attacks are still covering all areas of Gaza Strip. But let me start with the recent attacks that took place a short while ago in Deir el-Balah city here, whereas two simultaneous airstrikes hit the central area of Deir el-Balah city, targeting, as you know, a civilian vehicle leaving two Palestinian civilians dead, in addition to another attack that took place in the southern outskirts of Deir el-Balah city, leaving at least seven Palestinian civilians dead. A tragic massacre unfolded in that area after the Israeli occupation forces targeted that place in several airstrikes. And unfortunately, after the Palestinian people rushed to rescue the Palestinian casualties in that place, they were targeted as well by the Israeli warplanes. In the meantime, another horrific massacre unfolded in Al-Mawasi area in Khan Yunis city after the Israeli warplanes targeted several makeshift tents of the displaced people with these suicidal drones, leaving at least nine Palestinian civilians, many of them were women and children. And we understand clearly that all these attacks are still deliberate. They are systematic by the Israeli occupation forces in order to raise the death toll of the Palestinian people and excruciate Palestinian civilians even more. Let me remind you that the humanitarian situation on the ground is absolutely horrific for the Palestinian people, because the vast majority of the Palestinian people on the ground are no longer able to secure anything to eat.
The top UN expert on Palestinian rights says the U.S. decision to place her under sanctions could have a chilling effect on American people who engage with her and restrict her movement, but she plans to continue her work. Albanese, who now faces U.S. asset freezes and potential travel restrictions, warns that the U.S. decision could set a dangerous precedent for human rights defenders worldwide. She said it's scary that there are no red lines anymore. Albanese has repeatedly accused Israel of committing genocide in Gaza and criticized the U.S. policy on the war there. On Wednesday, Albanese was added to the U.S. sanction list for actions which U.S. officials cited a role in prompting prosecutions of Israeli leaders at the